And welcome to Cross Platform for September 20th, 2006, Episode 1.
Hello, this is Luke. I'm usually the host for the Game Act Hotline podcast, but today we're going to go and start a new show called Cross Platform. Now, the purpose of this show is not only for us to share with you guys more information about the business side and maybe parts of the video game industry that you may not know, but also give an opportunity for game journalists and even game podcasters to go ahead and share their podcast with you and maybe even give you guys a little bit more things to listen to on your iPod. So anyway, let's go ahead and let's start speaking of iPods. We have one guest. Her name is Omaha Sternberg. She is the host of the Macintosh Gaming Show. Is it iGame Radio?
iGame Radio, yep. It's broadcast on Mac Radio.
So we want to welcome her. We also have MC Wilson, host and producer of Broadcast Gamer at www.broadcastgamer.com.
Good evening. Good to be here.
And, of course, we have the great Tom Kim, who is the host and producer of the Gamma Sutra podcast for GDC Radio.
Hello, everybody.
So, anyway, let's go ahead and let's start with the biggest news that came up last week. And the first news was that the Apple iPod will now be having games on their system. Not only will there, well, there were some games, but now they're actually starting to really push for higher-end games such as Tetris, Zuma, and Bejeweled. And so I wanted to talk to Omaha about that. And can you give us a little bit more information about what happened?
Yeah, the Apple introduced iTunes 7 and declared there will be games on the iPod, fifth generation iPods only, but the games are available. If I recall correctly, it's $4.99 for each game to be downloaded. There's like, I think, six or eight games available at this point. They're small games. They're games like Tetris, Zuma that you mentioned, etc. We're not talking in-depth kinds of games. They're not the kinds of games that you would consider our competition for like the Nintendo DS or the Game Boy or anything like that. We're talking competition for mobile-style games, which is to be expected because the iPod, it doesn't have any kind of hardware for using for playing the kinds of games that you find on the DS or the Game Boy at this time. It works very nicely for the kinds of games that you would find on a cell phone at this time. So I think that Apple is trying to introduce it right now to see what the interest is for gaming on an iPod. Certainly, people have been begging for this kind of thing for a couple of years now. They've been asking and asking for this kind of thing to be happening, and Apple has accommodated. And the fact that they have actually introduced this on iTunes 7 with these particular games says something about the fact that the hardware has been that way. The hardware in the iPod has been introduced that way for a while now. They've actually been considering this for a while now. They just haven't said anything, which is kind of typical for Apple. They don't tell you a lot of stuff before they actually do it.
So do you think there's a bigger market nowadays for casual games? I know that me and you were at the casual gaming conference that happened here in Seattle, and it sounds like it's becoming a bigger interest with more gamers, and that it's becoming well known, and some of the console makers and AAA game makers are starting to consider it as a real gaming platform.
Oh, there's no question. Casual game market is really becoming pretty big, especially in the Mac market. I mean, it's just the biggest thing in the Mac market right now. And a lot of the PC and even the console games companies are starting to look at it and say, hey, you know, there's a big chunk of money out there that we're missing, and we'd like to start taking some steps into the casual games market and trying it out ourselves. So certainly, Luke, when you and I were at the Casuality Seattle 2006 back in June, we were seeing not a few PC gamers, or excuse me, PC publishers and developers that were looking and having already gotten demos or already gotten casual games. They were showing their casual games already in the market. And I'm not at all surprised at something like this. Mobile games are not exactly the same as casual games, but you can't really find people playing mobile games that aren't, I mean, you're not going to find people playing a mobile game that's like an RTS or something like that. So,
well, I think part of that has to do with the interface as well. This is Tom from Gamasutra Podcast speaking here. It's not like the more robust games are a surprise because, I mean, games have existed on even earlier generation iPods, but they're really more of a simple variety like Solitaire or, you know, there's a little, I forget what you even call it, but it's the game with a little rotating turret in the center where you shoot down the paratroopers and parachuters.
Right.
It's been around forever since the early days of the Apple II. But
yeah, and people have been able to put Doom on the iPod
yes,
as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That seems to be the de facto standard now. If you can put Doom on it, then you know that's
you can game on it.
Yeah, that's a challenge for a lot of gamers out there. But regardless, you know, people could see this coming because Apple had posted job, things on their job board for people who had mm-hmm. kind of low level programming experience doing casual games. So doing games in mostly C code or you know assembly or something that runs on you know Apple's or the iPod's operating system, which I believe is a variant of Linux. But anyway, yeah, it's something that people could see coming. But at the same time, as I said, you are limited as to what kinds of games you can play because of the interface. You've got the click wheel, which can sense the, you know, it's a touch sensitive. And you've also got the, you know, the four buttons on the wheel. But ostensibly, some of those would have to be set aside for breaking out of the game if you needed to break out of the game. So, you know, you've got a limited set of controls. Which, by the way, is another feature which I believe holds back mobile gaming because you're pretty, unless you happen to buy a phone which has some kind of a little joystick or directional pad on it, you're limited to doing gaming with the number pad. Well, at least the one thing that the iPod games have over mobile games is there's a stable, relatively stable platform on the iPod. A big problem in mobile game development is, you know, there's just so much variation in that space. I mean, lots of different screen sizes, lots of different, memory capacities on each of the devices, lots of different input methods. So anyone who's done development in the mobile space can tell you that, you know, it's a nightmare. Not to mention the fact that, you know, a lot of those games have to be localized for different markets and, you know, localization problems globally are always an issue, even for very small games like mobile games. Mobile gaming also, I think you're talking earlier about casual games and the rise of the kind of casual gaming market and casual gaming sector. I think they've been there for a while. I think NPD, Anita Fraser of the NPD, just released a report that more discreetly segments the gameplay population of North America into, I believe, 7 different categories. And this is a point that was gotten to in one of my earlier Gamasutra podcasts on gamer demographics, where a lot of the guests on the show and participants were talking about the fact that the designation casual game is really a bit of a misnomer because there are people who play, you know, many, many hours of online bridge or hearts or poker who wouldn't call themselves hardcore gamers. But, you know, if you look at the breakdown behaviorally versus by the kind of game they're playing or type of platform they're playing on, there are actually quite a few people out there who are gamers who might not describe themselves that way.
Yeah, that the term casual versus core gamer is a term that comes from marketing way back in the mid to late 90s when they were determining that casual or core gamers were based on how many games you bought during a month or a year and how often you played, and that was the only determination of how of which category that you were that you fell into, and those were the only two categories. But I think that one of the other things about the iPod is that unlike mobile games on a cell phone, people who have cell phones, their primary purpose for the cell phone, of course, is communication. And the games that are on there are sort of the afterthought of, oh, this is something to occupy my time when I have a little bit of time while I'm on the bus or have a little bit of time in between meetings or something like that. Whereas the iPod is primarily an entertainment device. It's being used as an entertainment device for people to listen to music and now suddenly for movies and for video games. And so I think that as a that already has a huge user base, I think that Apple is going to be able to take advantage of large numbers of people who are wanting to try to use up these games and try them out. And I think they're going to have a lot more people playing these games than mobile game companies had playing their games.
Yeah, and despite the popularity of the iPod, I mean, we've got to consider that the iPod is still competing for space in the pockets of people who already have cell phones. Despite the low quality of the games that are available for cell phones, they're selling remarkably well. I took a look the other day at what Singular has available, $3 a month for a game. Not just a flat fee, you're actually paying a subscription fee, and they're getting these dollars because cell phone games are making so much money, even though they're not very good. I think the fact that these games exist for the iPod at all could be telling if the rumors are true about Apple developing a phone. Because if these games are intended to be ported later to an Apple phone, and they're a better alternative to the games that are available for most cellular phones, that might give more people incentive to switch to Apple's phone.
You know, that makes sense. But Omaha, you alluded to this earlier, the core functionality of each of those devices is not gaming. Like an iPod is a mobile media player first and foremost. And right now, first and foremost, a mobile audio media player, not a video media player, as much as Apple would like people to believe that. And cell phones, of course, their killer app is mobile telephony, which is an absolutely killer app. I mean, it's getting to the point now where, you know, people used to not want to be that guy who had a mobile phone. Now the only reason you're not that guy with a mobile phone is if you're trying to make a statement that you don't have a mobile phone. So, yeah. You know, when you have that killer app underneath, you know, people talk about these various mobile devices as gaming platforms. Well, truth be told, it's remarkably difficult to launch a mobile or portable gaming platform. I mean, Nintendo's just got a hegemonic lock on that whole market. And I mean, witness what's happening now between the DS and the PSP. It's very, very difficult to break into that market for lots of reasons. But, you know, there's a number of interesting factors going on there. If you look at the installed base or the user base of cell phones versus iPods, there still are far more people who carry cell phones than there are who carry iPods because the core function is still greater.
Let's go back real quick. You guys were talking about how Apple and the different people are trying to get more of a demographic. Actually, MC had a very interesting story that he brought up about Iwata trying to, and you can see this with Nintendo nowadays, they're trying to get more of a demographic of not only just young boys, but also getting older people and getting other people with not only the Nintendo DS, but hopefully now with the Wii. I kind of find that interesting because we know that the general demographic of this last generation was mostly males, and it's looking like those dollars are starting to go downward, and so now it's starting to having to pick up with more people just to keep in line with the multi-million-dollar budgets of these newer games.
Well, Nintendo has said in the past that their strategy with this next console generation is to expand their market instead of just continuing to appeal to the same market that they previously have been trying to appeal to. And we've seen how that's been succeeding in Japan, at least, with the Touch Generations line of games available for the Nintendo DS, and even here to some extent. I know a lot of people that I never would have thought would be interested in games who bought a DS Lite just to play Brain Age. And if Nintendo can enjoy that kind of success with the Wii and the home consoles, they stand a very good chance by appealing to people who aren't gamers now of selling more systems and getting them in more living rooms.
Well, I think that's actually going to be a necessary thing for all the game companies, that is to think about broadening the market because, you know, I was mentioning this on the Evil Avatar podcast. A lot of these game companies and publishers now are publicly held. Therefore, they have a legal obligation to their stock, to their shareholders, to keep generating these returns, and these returns are predicated on a 15-year history of meteoric growth in the game industry, but they've been mostly selling to the same audience of people. And all of the analyst numbers, it's of course debatable whether analysts know what they're talking about or not all the time, but all of the current analyst numbers are saying that pool of people is shrinking, and that it's reaching a saturation point. Basically, they've been able to get these rise in sales numbers over the past 15 years because they've been able to command more and more expenditure out of that same pool. But there's only so much money and time that you can squeeze out of those people, and they're quickly reaching that saturation point. You know, especially with these next-gen titles costing as much to produce as they do, you know, how many $60 titles can one afford a month, and how much time does one have to play them? I believe it was GameDaily.com. There was an interview with Satoru Iwata talking about how this is going to be a long-term marketing challenge for them. He likens it to, you know, selling cosmetics to men because it isn't the traditional market that, you know, they normally sell to. So they're aware that they're going to need to take a patient approach and kind of seed in new audience members over time to their pastime.
And Tom, yeah, I think you're absolutely correct because it's amazing that I've talked with people over the past year who keep on saying that, yeah, we've got new demographics. There's all these studies that are saying that there's this huge market of women. There's this huge market of older women who are playing all these games, not calling themselves gamers, and yet there are this huge financial income that potential that is there and that people are not exploiting and that is there for us to get. And yet at the same time, over and over and over again, I hear from developers and publishers, their core market is still that 16 to 25-year-old male approximate age that is their target demographic. And the fact is that it's very, very hard. They're used to that demographic. It is very, very hard for them to move away from and think about a different demographic and think, because it means changing their entire strategy and reevaluating how they even develop games. I mean, because the games that you develop for males of that age group are very different from the games that you develop for women who are in their 50s or little girls that are in their tweens. I mean, you can't develop. You certainly cannot take a shooter and turn it into a shooter that shoots marshmallows and sell it to a 12-year-old girl, because it won't work. That's not the kind of games that they're interested in. So it requires them rethinking the whole strategy.
Well, also there's this point that most of the people who make games are within that same core demographic. And, you know, frankly, 70% of their income comes from that core demographic. So, you know, why would you avoid the lowest hanging fruit? It's not like you can shift away from that immediately. I mean, you have to cater to your core audience, because that's who's paying most of the money for the product that you make.
Even the core audience has got to get tired of this much of the same thing. At E3 this year, Microsoft press conference, they showed off many of the games that were coming up for Xbox 360. 5 or 6 futuristic sci-fi shooters that are all going to be rated M, I have no doubt. And then almost as a throwaway gesture, there's Viva Pinata, their so-called kids game. What else do they have? And it seems to be endemic of what's going on with many of the other systems, not so much the PlayStation 2, of course, because they have the huge market share so that almost anything will sell. But more and more with the next-gen consoles, you see really only one or two types of game, and they're all aimed at the same age group.
Well, there's a good reason for that. It's because it's low risk. It's a low-risk strategy.
Exactly.
We as gamers cry for more original content. We love it when, you know, something like Loco Roco or Cooking Mama comes out, or when there's, you know, when Shadow of the Colossus succeeds, or even games like Beyond Good and Evil and, you know, Tim Schafer's wonderful Psychonauts. Like, we wonder why people don't play more of these games. Well, you know, that's all fine and good if you're a gamer who loves the form of gaming. But if you're a marketer or if you're a publisher who's got to sell the games, you're going off of cold, hard data. And the fact is, originality doesn't sell. It just doesn't sell as well as the tried and true, for better or for worse. And these companies are publicly held. Like I mentioned earlier, they're investing tremendous amounts of money toward development of their titles. And look at the attrition rates. I think, like, I don't know, maybe only one out of, I think the latest figures say 1 out of 14 games even makes back the money that was invested in it. And that one game is expected also to carry the loss of profit and investment for the other games that are made. So that increasingly drives you toward a blockbuster model. Not only that, but something like, I think only 1 out of 5 games that gets approved for development actually sees Gold Master. That's a pretty steep attrition rate for titles. And if you're the person who's in charge of publishing, turning a profit in this very competitive and very busy market, that's a lot of pressure on you to say, like, you know, the, whatever, bless the guy at Majesco who approved, you know, Psychonauts and, you know, Advent Rising or whatever. But, you know, neither of those games did very well. I mean, Psychonauts, I think, was more of the loser in that category. Well, both were. But, you know, they spent a lot more money behind the promotion of Advent Rising with $1 million sweepstakes and all that. But, you know, I think Psychonauts in many ways was the more, quote unquote, interesting, more, you know, different game that was trying to take a different approach. And they just, you know, gambled that they'd have to put their money behind the one they thought would be more of a leader. But it's really hard to predict that kind of thing. I mean, I think there's a lot of kind of negativity in the air right now about, you know, about gaming in general. We're in a period of console transition. And for whatever reason, people are just, you know, they're really ripping on Sony. They're ripping on the developers. The analysts are all down on things. And, you know, but fact of the matter is, if you look at the product on the shelf and you look at where we are in the technology, I don't think there's a more exciting time. I don't think there ever, almost ever has been a more exciting time to be a fan of games than right now. We've got some tremendous new hardware coming out from companies that take very different approaches to what they're trying to do. We've got some wonderful game experiences already on the shelf. You know, a lot of people complain about this stuff, but the truth is, if you want an original game experience, you can find it. It's really, you know, not too hard to go out and you know, download stuff from the introversion software guys or from the vast, you know, ecosystem of casual gamers out there.
And the best place to go is, well, I mean, it's not just casual gamers, because when you talk about casual gamers, you're talking about people who produce casual games, and they can be people who are indie gamers, or excuse me, indie developers, or they can be those, you know, big time publishers like PopCap Games, or we're talking, you know, even larger than that, Real Arcade, who just, you know, in the past year or so purchased Gamehouse and is producing a huge number of casual games. They're a big time publisher. But if you want to get originality in games, where you're going to have to look for it is in the indie game market, because the indie game developer is the one who can put in a small amount of money and produce a small game, get originality, get people interested in it, and have somebody who is larger look and say, wow, that looks really interesting. I want to put some money behind it, especially considering how many people have looked at this and said, we love it and we want to play this game and we're diving on top of it. The originality doesn't come in the large game developers and game publishers. The originality comes when you see the indie developers developing.
Yeah, and you can kind of see that, especially, for example, it only costs about $100,000 to $300,000 to make an independent game, and then they probably make most of their money back. But for example, with Madden NFL Football, it's going to cost them $10 million, $20 million to create, and then they hope that, and especially with EA, most of their percentage of their money is actually made from the Madden NFL Football game. And so with more and more people working on, with more and more of the games having to make more money, and with knowing that the first-person shooter games make money all the time, and that they will go ahead and they'll stay with those as long as things are going good for them, which is it's a sad thing, because it kind of narrows their market back into those 12- and 15-year-olds. And then it also starts to bring the idea that many of the news people, as we talk about in the news, and there was a news story about how they put the demographic of game players as just kids, yet there, I know multiple people that are older in the 30s and 40s and also in their later ages, especially with the Nintendo DS and the Brain Age games that are actually getting into gaming.
And Tom brought up a good point earlier about game development costs, and I think that's another aspect of Nintendo's strategy that should bring them success in the next generation, is that not only are they trying to broaden their audience by making those sorts of different games that would appeal to more casual gamers, but they're also focusing on a system that's not necessarily so much powerful as the other two competitors in the next-gen console wars will be, but that is more affordable and that costs less to develop for. Because as we've seen with the success of the PlayStation 2, even almost a year after the Xbox 360's been out, and the continued success of the portable systems, a good game concept that resonates with people is going to sell better than games with intense graphics.
Well, sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Of course, we all hope that, you know, the great games will rise to the surface on their own, but, you know, the unfortunate truth is that doesn't always happen, or at least it doesn't always happen in a way that's measurable in profits.
But if they left to make, then they're more likely to make a profit than if the cost is absurdly much to make as a Gears of War or something from the next gen system.
And you're seeing more of that also, like with Microsoft and their XNA initiative. I mean, releasing that, you know, kind of open source developers toolkit to, you know, to homebrew gamers and to casual gamers out there for free. You know, where basically it's only going to be a $99 buy-in to distribute your content over Xbox Live. You know, and I think that's wonderful. I think that's going to be a wonderful source of new and interesting talent that, you know, we're just starting to see what kinds of things might come out of that. On Xbox Live Arcade, I think there have already been a few quite interesting offerings. And, you know, they've got some pretty interesting new projects in the works as well. Like, you know, developers like the Behemoth re-releasing Alien Hominid in HD and also working on Castle Crashers. I mean, those are relatively traditional kind of side-scrolling 2D beat-em-up games. But, you know, it's just the indie spirit behind them, I think, is wonderful and thriving. And certainly they're a press and a fan favorite. So, you know, more power to independent developers on platforms like Xbox Live Arcade. I think that's all a great thing. But it gets to an interesting notion, like Omaha, you were talking earlier about the non-hardcore gamer, like this kind of market segmentation. Well, unfortunately, some of that has bled over into how people consider themselves as well. Like, if you're to ask most people out there, do they consider themselves a gamer? A majority of people would say no.
Right.
And that's really, I think, the conception that Nintendo is fighting with the Wii. They're not fighting with Microsoft and Sony. They're fighting with the public perception of interactive entertainment in their homes, period. I mean, what they really have to do is seed in this idea that it's an acceptable form of recreation for the whole family. I think maybe in less time than all of us think, you know, this whole argument about games being a niche pursuit, and it's going to go away as the distinction between games as something which only gamers do versus something that everyone does goes away.
I think that's probably the biggest problem, especially because we want to feel that way and show the people that we also, that everybody plays games, but yet then we have things such as when we talk about video game violence, and it shows how a lot of people still think, oh, wait, that's only the kids are playing that. And yet it makes people go, oh, do you play video games? And it brings that idea of the violent video games, and that brings them to say no. And so they don't accept the idea of gaming. I find that is probably one of the big problems with the public.
Well, I think a lot of that's based off of a lot of misinformation, frankly, because if you look at the statistics on youth violence, they've been dropping precipitously,
exactly.
Directly within the same time frame that video games have risen to the fore as a true mainstream entertainment. So for all of these proponents that say that playing violent video games translates into violent behavior from young people, they're frankly ignoring the figures.
Yeah, exactly. Most of the studies that have been done, if you take a look at them in detail, what you really find is violence that's happening that can be explained as happening in concurrence with the playing of video games. In other words, people who are violent happen to enjoy also playing video games as well, not rather a causative factor. And many of the people who do these studies just will not accept the fact that causative can be a factor of these studies rather than, concurrent factor, that they're just happening in concurrence. These people happen to enjoy playing a more violent video game just simply because they are more violent people rather than the violence of the video games happening to be the cause of the violence in them. And none of these studies really are showing any cause at all. And yet I find over and over again, I get so offended by this because I'm a scientist trained, and I see over and over again people continuing to say that these studies are causative studies, and they just are not.
I'm a scientist trained as well. My undergraduate major was in neurobiology. Though I'm not a social science major, I've looked at a lot of the methodology in these studies as well, and a lot of it is flawed. But to be fair, measuring this kind of thing is very, very difficult.
It is.
Measuring media effects are very, very difficult. And this is an old, old debate. It doesn't just, you know, involve video games. It involves things as old as novels, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And
television.
You know, television and movies and, you know, and on
rock
and on.
Rock and roll.
Yes. It's just yet another thing that the video game industry, it's a growing pain thing. I think it's just our turn, basically, to go through the same inquiry and analysis that all these other media mm-hmm. have already gone through. But then again, yes, a lot of this research is flawed in methodology. There is no causative trace. There are researchers who are starting to look at that. But on the other hand, also to be fair, the game industry talks out of both sides of their mouth because they talk about using games as educational tools and training apparatus. So we're the first people to tout the positive aspects of interactive simulation, but the first people also who decry any kind of voice about the violent effects. But for what it's worth, this whole debate on the media effects thing isn't going to go away right now. It just happens to be a hot point because it makes for purple journalism. It's very, very easy for a newscaster to say, oh, well, these games are violent, and show a whole spate of violent game footage. And outside of the context of the people playing the game, outside of the context of how that child or that grown up behaves once they turn the game system off and go to the office and or go to school and interact with real life human beings, you know, and it's really easy to kind of demonize the industry and to put, you know, industry experts on the spot, you know. People who want to support the industry and say, you know, how can you justify this? How can you defend this? And, you know, they're showing some footage from Soldier of Fortune or something. I don't know. It's just because it's so easy to sensationalize.
It's also very easy for the politicians to be able to get their little pings or their large pings from their constituency by claiming, I'll save you from all the violence of these teenagers running into their schools and shooting off things by making video games illegal, blah, blah, blah. I'll solve your problem for you.
Yeah, and they failed so horribly with a lot of the laws that have been put up in the United States have been taken out. And then especially, I can kind of see this as a growing pain, as the movie industry had their growing pains with the Natural Born Killers movie. And that was another introduction of violence, and how could that affect our children. But then that also brings up the question of the ESRB. Is the ESRB actually doing the work that they're supposed to be doing? I mean, we know that the MPAA is starting to have some doubts, especially with a lot of people. And there's also been some doubts with the ESRB with their rating systems.
I think it's a mindshare issue. When we're talking about movies, often video games are compared to movies, especially since now they both have a rating system. Parents understand what a rated R movie is as opposed to a PG-13 movie, and they can understand that there's objectionable content there that they don't necessarily want their kids to see. But they grew up with movies. The parents grew up with movies, not just the kids. We are, as Tom mentioned earlier, now bringing up a generation of kids that did grow up with video games, and so they will have a better understanding of the rating system. But right now, I think what we have are a lot of parents that don't understand games and don't want to. What they would prefer is for their politicians to simply outlaw it and be done with it, instead of having to educate themselves about what their kids are or could be playing.
Oh, MC, you're just so spot on. I was in a doctor's office the other day, and I was watching this woman, this older woman, with what looked like her grandson talking to him, and he had to have been 14, 15 years old, talking to him about his playing Halo 2. And she was just talking to him about how he enjoyed playing it and stuff, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I don't think that you realize that that's not quite the game he should be playing right now. But the fact of the matter is that you're so spot on. A large proportion of the population, of the parental population at this point, do not understand the rating system. And I think that one of the benefits of all of the legislation that's been going on has been to kick the ESRB in the butt about getting more education out there. I think that they've been doing a good job so far, but I think that they haven't been. I think they haven't been proactive enough in educating the populace. And they've been the past year. They've been doing a lot more stuff in educating, even to the point of getting television ads out there about the ESRB and rating systems. So I think that that's one of the benefits of the legal action that's been going on.
MC, as you said, it is a mindshare issue. I think part of the problem is that, you know, a lot of parents just, in some ways, they're just so unfamiliar with the territory that they have no context for comparison. I mean, their conception of a video game is a toy for a child or an urban violence simulator. I mean, there's really nothing in between. They don't, you know, even my wife, who, you know, I play games all the time. I used to be in the industry, and there's games all over my house, but she knows surprisingly little about them. She's astounded when I show her something like Shadow of the Colossus or even, you know, Elder Scrolls IV Oblivion. I mean, she likes watching me play those games. But if it weren't for me, she said, she'd never know those games existed because they're just simply not in her house. And, you know, with parents, I think it's also a more complicated issue. Omaha, you had mentioned earlier in the program that you're a parent. I'm a parent as well. I mean, you do want to protect your children from as much as you can for as long as you can, like within reason. I mean, you don't want them to live this kind of cloistered, sheltered existence, but you certainly don't want to expose them to things that are inappropriate for their age group or their level of social development. So, you know, for a lot of these parents, it's like they don't know enough about games to moderate their function or the usage. So, you know, it is a tricky proposition that people have to deal with. For the politicians, I think a lot of them, you know, probably know more about the issue than they let on. But I think it's a remarkably cynical thing, because what they want to do is to appear that they're being active on a social issue that doesn't require a large, complicated solution. Actually, a lot of the solutions we're talking about to fix some of these things require, they're generational. I mean, they're embedded within our educational system. They're embedded within how, you know, education's paid for by where you happen to live. You know, these things aren't easily solvable by politics. So they'll go after something like the video games debate because it can appear to make them look like they care about a social issue, which is telling to parents and that parents don't know a whole lot about. And frankly, that a lot of other politicians don't know a whole lot about. Yet it can make them appear like they're doing something socially proactive to right a wrong, to remedy an ill. When in fact, the matter is that, you know, there's a lot of important issues to look at here in terms of free speech and in terms of, you know, creators' rights in this country. I mean, you know, the status of games as a legitimate medium, as an art form even, that are just being trampled all over. Now, the good news is on the federal level, we've been lucky so far. Most of the judges recognize that the federally appointed judges recognize that these issues are serious and First Amendment protections have to be put in place, and they slap these measures down. But for a lot of the politicians that are proposing these measures, they don't care because they just want to get their talking point out. They just want to look to the electorate that we're trying to do our job, and darn those federally elected judges, they're slapping us down. But hey, I did my part. And who wants to be the politician who says, hey, I'm for these violent murder simulators? None of them want to be in that spot. So it's easier for them to, you know, go with the flow and pass the majority vote. I mean, because like, what are you going to do? To explain the issue takes time and education and context, things which aren't friendly to our soundbite friendly media.
And I so stress that this is an issue that is a parental issue. I mean, the parents are the ones who are responsible for educating, for getting themselves educated. And I mean, I believe the ESRB must get the information out so the parents know where the information is and they can get that education. But only the parents can look at their children and decide, my child is old enough for this game and my child is not old enough for that game.
Well, I was just going to say that Nintendo is, as we mentioned earlier, making efforts to broaden the market. And if they're successful, this could be a good side effect, is that more parents would be playing games with their kids, not just because they want to be good parents, but because they actually enjoy doing it. If they can get people playing games for that reason, no doubt they'll become more informed about gaming in general and what games are available.
And then we can all forget about Jack Thompson.
Yes!
But anyway, that's going to be...
Somebody needs to put him in a shooter.
Anyway, I think that's going to be it for this episode of Cross Platform. I want to go ahead and thank Omaha Sternberg over at iGame Radio. You can visit that at www.macradio.com, and there's a link to her show. I also want to thank MC Wilson, host and producer of Broadcast Gamer at broadcastgamer.com, and of course Tom Kim from the Gama Sutra podcast at gamasutra.com. or gdcradio.net. So I'm going to go ahead and thank you guys all for coming, and we'll go ahead and we'll have another one in the next couple weeks. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So thank you guys for listening to the Cross Platform Show. Let me go ahead and give you guys a disclaimer before we go. The expressed opinions given at this show are the opinions of the person and not of their parent, affiliate, or subsidiary company or podcast. If you want to learn more information about the show, you can go ahead and go to www.gameaddicthotline.com, where you can go ahead and click on links to the other people's shows and things that were talked about on the show. If you're interested in becoming a guest at Cross Platform or would like to comment on the show, you can go ahead and email me at gameaddicthotline@gmail.com. And we'll go ahead and we'll contact you. We'd also like to thank Nilsoft for the music for the intro and outro of this show. We also want to go ahead and thank all of those who were here, and also want to see you guys next time for our next show. We'll hopefully have it in 2 weeks. So until then, you guys have a good day and keep on gaming. This show was produced by Luke Stapley, copyright 2006.